Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome back to the Prepoint Pod. Today I am very happy to introduce Dr. Megan Critchley, who is a postdoctoral associate with the Sport Injury Prevention Research Centre at the University of Calgary in Canada. And she's going to talk about some of her research that looks at injury in pre-professional dancers. I was very lucky to be able to watch Megan present her research at the International Association for Dance Medicine Science Conference in 2022, and it's wonderful to talk to her about it today. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, Dr. Megan Critchley. Welcome to the Prepoint Pod.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. I'm quite excited to talk to you today because I've really enjoyed reading your research, and it's always really nice to put a face to research papers. So thank you very much for joining me.
I'm so honored to be here. I'm excited to talk about it.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself, so your background and how you came to be a dance researcher?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of have a roundabout way that I ended up studying dance science or becoming a dance researcher. I grew up dancing. I probably started dancing around 7 or 8, but I was also a competitive gymnast, so I would leave gymnastics practice and go to a dance class maybe once or twice a week. And I found that that was a really relaxing activity for me. It was way less stressful. It was more fun. Not that gymnastics wasn't fun, but I wasn't a competitive dancer. So it was just going to a class to just have fun and dance for the hour. And so then I just kind of continued to dance through high school and add more classes on as I went. And then I eventually moved on to the University of Wyoming, where I didn't know what I wanted to study at first. I was thinking I would go to med school. And so I thought, I'm going to be taking all these boring science classes that I'm going to find hard. So I added a dance class to my schedule, thinking that it would be the same as what I'd experienced when I was younger, kind of just something to do to relax and get my mind off things. And what I didn't know is the University of Wyoming actually has an undergraduate dance science program. It's led by Dr. Margaret Wilson, and at the time it was also co-led by Jennifer Deckert. And so I started taking dance classes, and I started in the program, and they introduced me to the dance science program, and I was like, oh, this is a perfect fit for being pre-med, or I kind of started thinking about physio school, and I was like, this is great. I can do all my dance courses and also take some science classes and then go to med school or physio school afterwards. And after I graduated, I shadowed in a physiotherapy clinic for a year and really liked the one-on-one connection with patients, but found that I had all these questions about what was going on, and thought that research would be a better fit. So I actually ended up staying at the University of Wyoming and doing a master's in kinesiology, where I specialized in biomechanics. And I did a totally unrelated project to dance. I was thinking, oh, I'll be this biomechanist that's really into math and forces and acceleration. And then I attended an iADAMS conference in Houston, just to go for fun, kind of, and learn about the dance science research. And that's where I met Dr. Sarah Kenny, And we got to talking, and I ended up moving up to Calgary and doing a PhD with her. And I kind of got to blend my two passions for science and biomechanics and dance. And then that's kind of continued. So I completed my PhD in dance science with Sarah. And then I'm now working as a postdoctoral associate in the Sport Injury Prevention Research Center at the University of Calgary. And I'm still studying injury epidemiology in dancers. So it's kind of been, I had all these ideas for where I wanted to go, and it just kind of really fell in my lap and worked out really well. And so now I'm a dance researcher.
That's so cool. It's interesting because I also went to the conference in Houston and presented like a little, I guess it was more like a pilot thing that we'd done with the dancers here in Queensland. And yeah, that was a really cool conference. And I do remember, like seeing all these people like Sarah Kenny and Matthew Wyon and all these big dance research names that, you know, you read in your research papers and you reference them, and then suddenly there they all are on the dance floor on the party night, you know, and it's yep. interesting conference. Like, it's a lot of good fun. But yeah, that conference definitely sparked an interest in dance research for me as well, because it wasn't something that I knew I really wanted to do. But yeah, it was a great conference. Maybe we walked past each other.
We probably did. We were probably on the dance floor together.
Probably were. Yeah. So there you go. So tell us about the main focus of your research work, so your PhD research work.
Yeah, so the main focus of my PhD research work was an injury epidemiology and injury surveillance study in pre-professional adolescent ballet dancers at a vocational school here in Calgary. And so, yeah, the majority of my work is focused on describing injury prevalence, incidents, and like location and mechanism characteristics of injury in that population. My work now as a postdoc, we're trying to branch out a little bit and kind of get into more of the private studio sector, because I think we're realizing that we see really high injury rates in pre-professional schools and elite dancers, but what's happening to them before they reach that level, because a lot of them come in already injured or they've had an injury that they're still coping with. And so how is that, what's going on at the studios, I think, is kind of where we're interested in looking. So overall, though, the ultimate goal of my research is just to reduce the burden of injury in dancers. So establishing some injury estimates so that we can start to implement some injury prevention strategies in these populations.
So is that implementing the injury prevention strategies in the community, kind of, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're starting with the vocational school we work with already, because we have an established relationship with them, but and it's just way more easy. It's easier to control variables in a vocational school like that, where they're all training the same. Studios come with their whole set of challenges, but the goal is to get more into the community and that kind of level.
I completely agree. I think, yeah, with, you know, it is much easier to study one particular school because they have, you know, X number of students that are all dancing, they're the same age, the same level, you know, mm-hmm. the same hours a week, timetables the same. Yeah. And yeah, so many different studios have different commitments and different teachers and different syllabuses and different. Yeah. Wow. That's great. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'll keep a lookout for what you come up with. That's
so yeah, let's hope it goes well. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure it will. So going back to last year, there was another IADAMS conference, but it was in Ireland. And I didn't go because I'm on the other side of the world, but I watched online and I watched you present your paper, Injury Epidemiology in Pre-Professional Ballet Dancers, a 5-year prospective cohort study. Would you like to tell us a bit about that research process and maybe some of the challenges that you faced as well?
Yeah, so this was a big portion of my PhD work. And I should preface this by saying this was built off of the project that Dr. Sarah Kenny originally started in 2015 for her PhD. And it wasn't actually supposed to be my PhD at the beginning. We had this whole biomechanic asymmetry study and rehabilitation study that we were going to do, but it was supposed to begin data collection in September of 2020, which obviously didn't work out due to COVID regulations at the time. But I kind of lucked out because we had been conducting this study since 2015. So at the time we were in year five, and we're now in year eight of that study. So it's, we have a really well-established relationship with them. And so what ended up happening is we started looking into this giant data set we had of all this injury surveillance we've been doing for these past 5 years at the time when I was looking into my PhD at this school. And overall, the way this process works is we've just implemented a standardized injury surveillance program at this particular school. So at the beginning of their academic year, so either end of August or beginning of September, we go in for 2 or 3 days of preseason screening, and we do some range of motion testing, lumbopelvic control, dynamic balance, some hip strength testing, all very similar to what other pre-screening programs use. And then they answer some questionnaires surrounding their injury history and their medical history. And then they also fill out a athletic coping skills inventory that kind of measures how they deal with stress or how they deal with criticism or things like that. And then basically we see them at the beginning of the year, they fill out these surveys, they do all their preseason screening measures. And then for the rest of the year, every week they receive an online survey. They receive the ostracy survey where they ask, and it just asks if they were injured that week. And then there's some follow-up questions on if they were injured, did they modify, things like that. And then it asks how many hours they spent in rehearsal, class, or performance. So it's a pretty, it's very similar to most sport injury epidemiology research. So that's the basics of what we do. I will say some challenges that we had. I think that was the second part of your question. So obviously the pandemic affected our data collection for some of those years. So the 2020 year was cut short. There was 1 year where we didn't really get any data. We weren't able to collect data. And then even into last year, the dancers have kind of been back and forth between in-person and virtual. So that's led to some challenges of measuring their exposure because, and some of them have been out sick. You know, they have to take 2 weeks off when they get COVID or something like that. So the pandemic, I think, has just thrown a wrench in this research, all research really. But I think everybody kind of knows that about it. It's just an asterisk on every study that was going on in those years. But, and then another challenge we faced is the self-reported nature of the surveys. So Dr. Kenny's paper from the first year of the survey talked about how a self-reported injury definition is probably more appropriate for dancers because for a variety of reasons. So I do think the self-reported nature that we use is most beneficial, but this school, during the time that we've been there, some years has had an on-site physio and other years hasn't. So there are some years where we're able to kind of cross-check the injury data we're getting with physio reports and get, you know, a diagnosis, or we get more information on mechanism or things like that. And then the years where we don't have that information, we just kind of have to go on what they tell us. But I do think this kind of highlights one of the biggest problems or the biggest challenges in dance injury research is the arts in general are underfunded. And we're working at a vocational school, at a ballet vocational school, right? So if anything's going to be funded, it's going to be this population within the dance world. And I think if we're finding that even they are struggling to have the funding to have appropriate medical care, like what's going on at the studio level is going to be a totally different story or different genres. So I think this is a challenge that we'll continue to face in dance injury research is how do we accurately capture a measure of injury when we don't have the ability to have these medical professionals providing diagnoses all the time. I would say that's one of our challenges as well.
I think I was actually really impressed by the participation rates and the number of students that actually were responding to that survey. Like, it was really high. And that was very surprising to me because, you know, obviously I've danced myself and I've been around ballet dancers from all different schools and all different places for so long. And one of the things I think that comes up time and time again is just that the culture of underreporting, and when it's, you know, something that they don't want to share with the teacher necessarily, like they're not even going to tell their parents sometimes, you know, because, or, you know, they, there's a different story about how long something's been hurting with one person versus another person. And I mean, I suppose as researchers in that space, you were able to be a little bit removed from that. Like, it's not as though you were reporting that information to the teaching staff, or they still needed to go and seek physiotherapy treatment, I suppose. But yeah, it, I think that sort of fear of being injured or fear of telling somebody that there's something wrong in case you have to stop dancing, like that, I think would have been challenging just knowing ballet culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the surveys aren't anonymous, but they're online and only we see them. They're the artistic staff at the school doesn't. And so I think that really helps. And that's why we've seen the self-reported injuries. That injury rate is so much higher than the medical attention or time loss. And it's totally because they don't want to tell someone that's going to tell them you can't dance this week. Like, they would much rather just modify or stay silent, which is a culture change that I think is slowly happening. It does help that we've been working with this school for so long, so we've been able to do that. But that's something that takes investment and time and attention, and that's not the case that every studio or school or university has. So yeah, it's definitely a culture shift that needs to happen, and I think it's coming, but takes a minute for sure.
Your comment about funding too is also very, very real. And even sort of looking at, you know, if there are any dance studios that have a physio involved, even at the community level, we'll have a physio come in once a week, you know, but that's often not enough time to see every student, you know. And certainly mm-hmm. the school that I work at, that's how the service started, and it's thankfully built up. But, you know, it's taken a lot of time and a lot of funding and a lot of, you know, people who are senior in the organization recognizing that it's an issue that needs to be addressed. And whereas, like, thinking of a community school that might still have, you know, 300 odd students, but, you know, a physio might come in like one afternoon a week or something to do triage, like, it's just not enough to really capture any sort of meaningful and accurate data, right? Like, you really need someone there pretty much every day, or some kind of online reporting system like you had to encourage people to report things, I guess. Yeah,
absolutely.
And did you find, like, when the students were reporting to the researchers that there was a fairly, like, large number of those students that then went to see the physio as well? I don't know if you can speak to that, but
So I should know these numbers off the top of my head, but I would say that I think we had a prevalence of like 67% reported an all complaints injury, or that self-reported injury. And I think our medical attention was closer to, I think it was closer to like 40 to 50%. So That's a pretty good chunk of the ones that are saying they're injured are going to see someone. Some of them utilized the on-site staff the years that it was there, and a lot of them have their own care that they go see. But within the first 3 years of the data, we did see a trend that the medical attention injuries were increasing, which meant that more and more of them were going to see physios. So the overall rates didn't change. They stayed pretty consistent, but we saw that more and more of them were going to get some medical attention for their injuries in the first 3 years. And then it kind of leveled off around year four and year five.
That's quite positive, really.
Yeah.
Great. That's good. Yeah. Trends going in the right direction.
Yeah, that's what we want to see.
Oh, yeah. And so talking about, you know, medical attention injuries and all complaints injuries, like, there are a couple of different ways that time loss injuries in dance and in like sports epidemiology as well, there are a couple of different ways that we can measure time loss injury. So how did you classify a time loss injury? And also, like, what are your thoughts about selecting this measure, and why is it important to select the correct measure for young dancers particularly? Sorry, there's like four questions in there at once.
No, I'll try and remember them all. I'm pretty sure this is a question that came up in my PhD defense, so I should know the answer. But yeah, so I think the first part was, which time loss definition did we use? So we used a time loss definition that's actually recommended by the IADAMS consensus from 2012, which is 1 day missed of class, rehearsal, or performance or more. And that's not counting the day that they are injured. So it's from they get injured that day, and then if they don't come the next day, that counts as a time loss injury. I think that's also the definition that's recommended by the International Olympic Committee. So we used that. So 1 day missed, 1 or more days of class, rehearsal, or performance missed. The second part of the question, I think, was why is it important which one we choose?
Yeah, why is it important to select, the right measure, especially for young dancers?
Mm. Yeah, so we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but due to the nature of dance practice and dance culture, specifically ballet culture, there are some pretty serious limitations to this definition within this context, because there's several published papers that kind of talk about this, but the one that's coming to mind is one by Annie Jeffries in 2020, showing that dancers don't really take time off when they're injured. Instead, what they do is modify, especially when they're at this elite level. So I think that study was in professional dancers, but it happens in a pre-professional cohort as well, where these dancers are well attuned to their bodies and they're able to go to class and modify what they're doing. So either they do the choreography on the other side, or they don't jump that day, or something like that. So when we just define an injury as something that causes them to lose time, we're not really capturing what's happening, what's affecting them in class, because they just don't take time off. They don't want to, they're scared to. There's repercussions if they do sometimes, and it's just, it's not going to happen. So it's not the best definition for this particular population. So in youth who are a little more impressionable, and there's this really severe power dynamic, specifically in a ballet school, between them and their teacher or their artistic director, speaking up and saying you're injured is a little scary sometimes. And so I think we've just found that this time loss definition isn't the best for this particular group. And that's not to say that a time loss definition can't ever be used. I think it totally depends on your research question. A lot of times time loss definition is used to describe severity of the injuries. So I think what you'll find in a lot of dance injury epidemiology research is that all definitions are included. So we included all three. We did an all complaints definition, we did a medical attention, and we did time loss, because I think they all tell you something that's going on in that population. So I think it depends on your research question. I don't want it to sound like I'm saying like time loss definitions are the worst, like don't ever use them. That's not true. And it might, those that might be applicable in a different dance context. So different genre, or different, if you're looking maybe at a, I don't want to come up with a research question off the top of my head, but that could be used in some other context. It just isn't the right one for this particular study.
I think it's really hard working in this space myself, maybe only seeing a dancer. Well, for example, especially, you know, clinically, if you only see a dancer once a week, for example, for an injury. And then if you're also classifying like whether they're taking time off, whether they're off, and sometimes those injuries are really easy because, you know, it's something like a, you know, quite a significant ankle sprain, and there's no way you're going to try and dance on it, right? So it's very easy to say you're off, or something like a stress fracture where you're like, yep, you're off. But like, as you say, like dancers will often modify, and I reckon that definitely in the pre-professional and professional space, that's kind of the culturally accepted norm. Like, if you can get up and move your arms, like, you should be doing something, like, you should be there doing something in rehearsal. Like, that's kind of what the culture is. And I think in some cases, like, you can go on stage and just like hold a tray of cups, and like, you're performing, like, you're being paid and you're useful. Like, you're useful to the company, you're useful to the, you know, to the school. So, you know, that's actually a proper role that someone would have to do. You know, or you might walk on and wave a fake chicken in the air, or you might sit on the side of the stage and beg, like, but you're still a character on the stage, right? But you're still not like maybe doing a role that involves jumping or involves point work or involves lifting or something like that, right? So even though you're modifying, like, you're modifying, and I think when you're seeing dancers once a week, like, sometimes it can change so quickly too. Like, sometimes you can modify things for yourself for a couple of days, and then things sort of get better, and then you might try a little bit more, and then it goes back to, oh no, actually it's getting sore again, so I'm going to stop jumping again. And then it sort of like goes up and down and up and down. And it's a really difficult thing to capture, I think. Yeah. Clinically,
yeah.
In a research sort of space. And I think it's very easy to say, yes, a dancer's off, but it's, you know, there are some dancers that will modify and they may not jump for months. Like, mm-hmm. We should totally be including that information in a time loss definition somehow. I think it's just really hard to do that with the items definition. But I guess then also, like, when you think about it from a professional dancer's point of view, if you are off, like, generally you have to be replaced. So I think from a finances perspective for a company, like, if you're having to replace a dancer, then that is also quite financially significant for a company. So I also see why that full-time loss definition is used, where you're having to take a day or more off as well. But it is such a tricky thing.
I think it's the age-old question that will probably be debated for years in sport and dance injury epidemiology, especially when, because you were kind of talking about this, and I didn't earlier, but one of the big things we also find in dance injury is that a lot of these injuries are gradual onset or chronic injuries. And so, yeah, just like you said, they come see their physio once a week, and maybe it's a good day and it's not flaring up or whatever, and then 3 days later it comes back. And so do we count that as a new injury, or is this just an ongoing problem? Like, there's a whole thing with gradual onset injury that also makes the time loss definition really difficult, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, there's no black and white, which is quite unfortunate, because for researchers, we really like a bit of black and white every now and then.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Another question to do with sort of the nitty gritty of your research. So when we're talking about rates of injury, or incidence of injury rather, there are ways we can compare, say, like, one company to another company, or one school to another school. And what we usually do is we usually measure the number of injuries that happen over a certain number of hours of training, or a certain number of exposures, like classes or something. And usually that number's 1,000 hours or 1,000 exposures. So what are some of the reasons that we would choose one injuries per 1,000 hours versus injuries per 1,000 exposures? And what did you use for your research?
Yeah, this is a great question. And this is, you're just really getting into it. This is another like debate.
Can you tell that this is also part of my research as well?
Yeah, this is another debate that will be ongoing for a while, I think. Yeah, so in our study, we used 1,000 hours. And that was because they did their online survey where they filled in themselves how many hours they spent. And so we were able to use 1,000 hours. And we were able to do it on an individual basis. 1,000 exposures is often used when like, let's say we didn't have this individual contact with them, and all we were able to do is go in at the beginning of the year and say, can you give us the timetable or the schedule for these dancers? And we could say, well, we know everybody's in grade 10 and they're supposed to be in ballet 3 times a week. So that's how many exposures they've had. And so I think if you're able to capture that hourly data, it's a little more precise per individual dancer. There's nothing wrong with exposure data. And I think exposure data is something that's often way more feasible for large scale studies when you just use the count of exposures. I think the limitation with both of them, and I think this is kind of where the future conversation is going, is that neither one of these is actually a measure of the intensity of how long they've been training. So we can give an instance rate that says they got 2.5 injuries per 1,000 dance hours, but what if those 1,000 dance hours were, they went to rehearsal for 2 hours and they're in the core sitting on the floor in the back while the rehearsal director is working with the principal the whole time? Or yeah, what if it's the rehearsal where you're going through the part of every ballet where you're all just like walking around pretending to talk to each other? That's way different. That's way different than the rehearsal that you have where you're doing jumps or where you're turning a bunch or where you're running the whole show from top to bottom. Like, all of the demands of those are very, very different. So I think what we're finding is eventually there's going to have to be some measure of intensity of that exposure, rather than just, yeah, these dancers dance a lot. We think they're dancing about 25 hours a week, but what that dancing entails, we're not totally sure.
Exactly. Yeah. This is, yeah. And it's so difficult from so many perspectives, because, you know, when you sort of looking at the number of hours that a lot of dancers do, you go, wow, that's a lot of hours. And you try and sort of think, well, how is the intensity managed? So I might have, yeah, there might be literally like a drama lesson where the students are walking around and acting with each other. And then, yeah, you've got like the full rehearsal, but totally, if you're not in the first cast or if you're begging on the side of the stage and that's your role, like the intensity of that is very low. So versus if you're, yeah, as you say, like if you're the principal couple and you're doing a whole lot of pas de deux and you're on point a lot, and yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, and there are so many people who have tried to measure intensity, and the way that we measure intensity in sports is sometimes not that applicable to dance. It's really hard to put on a wearable in a theater, for example, when you're supposed to be like in a costume. You know, how do you wear a watch, or how do you wear some kind of GPS tracker in a tutu?
Like, yeah. Strap a heart monitor around your chest, yeah. Underneath your skin tight costume. Like, that's just not always an option.
Well, and you know what, for the researchers that work with Riverdance, like they actually have done that, because they can put, mm-hmm. they can put a heart rate monitor underneath a Riverdance costume, but like, this is Irish dancing, but
yeah.
Not always possible if you're doing, you know, one of the male solos where you're not even wearing a shirt, like
how does that we're just gonna have to start adding these into the costume design of,
yeah, well, I mean,
everybody will have a wearable on.
Yeah, totally. Like, yeah, I mean, dancers are great at hiding stuff, right? Like, even taping, you know, taping has to be invisible, or like, mm-hmm. So I'm sure that one day there'll be something that's small enough and that we can wear, maybe.
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, I think your comment about measuring hours versus exposures is always, yeah, very valid. And I think the schedule, it doesn't always sort of give you who attended each rehearsal or if someone was off sick, or so having a self-report is definitely useful, I think. Cool. So okay, to sort of start summing things up, this has been such a great chat, but what were 2 key findings from your study that you wish all pre-professional ballet schools knew?
That's a great question. So I think the first thing I wish they all knew is, and the kind of the main finding of this paper, was that injury rates were consistent across all 5 years. So, and they varied a little bit, but not much, right? So I think what this body of work and this study has done so far is really cement the fact that pre-professional dancers and pre-professional ballet training comes with a risk for injury. Like they're getting injured, and they're getting injured a significant amount. So we saw 2.54 injuries per 1,000 hours, and 1,000 hours equates to almost their training year from September to June. So they're getting injured 2.5 times through a year, which is a lot. That's when that compared to other sports, that's more than other sports. And so, and we saw this happen from year to year to year to year, which means there's a great opportunity for injury prevention here, right? And what I want pre-professional ballet schools to know is, so we're seeing this consistent injury rate, which means there's a risk for injury, which isn't a bad thing, but it does mean that there's going to have some small changes that happen in our training, in our ballet training. And whether that changes periodization or load management or neuromuscular training, something like that, that totally remains unseen at this point. That's areas for future study of trying these injury prevention strategies and seeing if they reduce injuries. But that means it's time to start exploring these options, which I think means that our stakeholders, so our artistic directors, our the people who create the syllabi at these schools, need to be open to adding these things into their training. And what that means is that it maybe means that dancers don't need to be, I think in ballet training, we think, you know, these dancers need to be dancing 25 hours a week, but maybe we just need to optimize their training more. You know, we don't need to have them in rehearsal for 3 hours all the time. Maybe it's we have 1 hour of really intense, good rehearsal rather than, yeah, more time doesn't equal better quality. And so I think it just means that there needs to be a culture change where we're open to trying these injury prevention strategies, which is going to cause a shift in our typical training. And that kind of leads me to the second thing that I wish they all knew. And this is from another study from my PhD, which I don't think has been officially published yet, but it's been accepted. So I wish they knew that psychological coping skills, so one of those surveys they fill out at the beginning of the year, it plays a role in injury risk. So other studies have found, I think the study group at Code Arts has also found that these poor coping skills are associated with a risk for injury. And in our study, it was a confounder. So they're playing a role. And so I think this is intuitive to most dancers and dance teachers, but we need to be looking at injury prevention from a more holistic model and not just these physical anthropometric measures. So we're never going to find that just one screening test is going to predict injury risk. It's a combination of a bunch of things, and that includes what's going on with our mental health and not just our physical health. So yeah, I think those are the two things that we need to be, we have consistent injury rates, so we need to be open to some injury prevention strategies, and that those strategies need to be a little more holistic rather than just targeting one specific risk factor.
I completely agree with you. And I think that from my experiences working in this field as a physio and having these conversations with various teachers, I think that the general vibe is that this is what teachers are realizing is needing to happen. I think it's just such a difficult thing to go, okay, well, where do we start? Because there are so many things that you could change, like, or, you know, so many sort of strategies you could implement, right? Like, yeah. And I think how do we choose the one that's going to work? And it's like, well, maybe it's just like chipping away at things, like, and like you say, you have to test the theories, right, before you implement things and go through that whole process again of measuring and remeasuring and measuring and remeasuring and working out which ones work best. Yeah, and I would completely agree with you from my clinical experience too. I think being in a mentally good space is very, very beneficial for dancers, and how you end up in a mentally good space is influenced by so many factors too. So I mean, I know a lot of dancers move away from home to train, and, you know, having those sort of social supports at home and you know, obviously things like, you know, fueling, like fueling has an impact on mental health and mental health has an impact on fueling. And there's that. And then things like the schedule being so demanding, you know, how much rest and recovery, like there are so many things.
Yeah. So they're all interrelated. Yeah.
Totally. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that's such an interesting finding and I'm looking forward to reading that paper and probably referencing it. Speaking of references, what are two other papers that you love to reference when in your research that other dance researchers should 100% read?
Okay. So I actually cheated and I have three.
Yeah, that's fine.
The first one I feel like is kind of a given, sort of. So the first one I would say is the International Olympic Committee, so the IOC consensus statement on methodology for reporting and recording injury.
Bar
2020. Because I think if we start there in the dance science world, and we're getting there, I think that's been widely adopted and it's continuing to be, but what's plagued dance injury research for a while is that people are using different methodologies and so we can't compare very easily. And then I would say the second one would be Dr. Kenny's first paper on injury definition. So from 2018. So this is the one I kind of talked about earlier that talks about how the different injury definitions estimate the burden of injury in pre-professional ballet dancers. And that's the one that highlights that maybe all complaints or self-reported definition might be the best for this population. But I think it really helps outline which definitions should be used for which research question. And then the third one I have is a really great qualitative study from Caroline Bowling and the group in Amsterdam, discussing the perspectives of injury and injury prevention in pre-professional dancers and artistic directors. So I think this speaks to the culture surrounding injury. And I think that paper is from 2019 or 2020. It might be 2021, sorry. But it has a cute title. It's like In Their Shoes, and talks about how artistic directors or teachers view injury versus professional dancers and who feels like they're responsible for injury prevention, things like that. And I think as we move from the injury epidemiology space into the prevention space, I think this provides really great context for how we can implement injury prevention strategies. And I think it highlights how when we start discussing these injury prevention strategies, we need to bring the stakeholders to the table. So certain methods are never going to work when we don't ask the dancers or ask the artistic directors themselves how these things can be implemented. All that's going to happen is just getting a bunch of pushback and it's just not going to be successful. So I would recommend that one as well. But there's too many. There's so many to choose from. Anything by Shaw Bronner and their group studying, they have, you know, a longitudinal study in modern dancers, and then everything that's going on at the Royal Ballet with, I think, Joseph Shaw and their team.
Yeah.
So you really can't go wrong. There's a bunch.
Mm. Yeah. And there's more and more. And I think in the past, probably 3 or 4 years, there's been some really good ones. It's, it's great. Thank you. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
Dr. Megan Critchley's recommended reading. It's great.
There's a huge reading list.
Oh yeah, there always is.
Yeah.
The EndNote library just keeps growing.
Yeah, it does.
So the last question I have actually is completely unrelated to your research, but did you ever dance on point? And if so, what are your preferred pair of point shoes?
I was actually prepared for this question because I was listening. I was like, I know everybody gets asked this. I did end up dancing on point, but not until I went to university. So my first year was all, maybe just my first semester was all just flat. And then our second semester, all of a sudden they were like, we're doing point, which I was not prepared for. And I was pretty horrible. I was pretty terrible at point. It was a hard time to start, but the first pair of shoes I ever had came from a box that a dancewear store had donated to the university. And so I just kind of reached in and grabbed ones that I thought would be okay. I have really small feet, so I just picked the smallest ones, and they happened to be block. And then eventually I did go and like actually get fitted and stuff, but I stuck with block from there on. Yeah, I'm sure if I look back on my first semester during Point, I would be like, this is risk for injury 101 right now. Like, I'm wearing ill-fitting Point shoes. I'm super not prepared for this, but it got better.
That is such a talk about being thrown in the deep end. Like, that is, yeah, that's scary actually.
I should say that, like, my instructors knew that I hadn't done it.
Right.
So I mean, I was taught, we started small and I had to take a beginning Point class on the side, but yeah, I was thrown into a Point class that I was not prepared for, but it got better. And I will say that my instructors never forced me to do anything that I wasn't ready for or I shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
Whether that means I didn't try it on my own time just to see if I could, that's
to be better. I think a lot of dancers do that.
Yeah.
I know I certainly did. On carpet, tried different things that I probably shouldn't have been doing. But I mean, I guess that's just part of being motivated too. I mean, we're probably never going to stop that. Wow. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been a really great chat. Thank you so much for your time. And yeah, I think this is going to be a really educational episode for a lot of our listeners. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's always fun to talk about your research, and
yeah,
it's always fun to hear that other people value it and are using it. So thanks so much.
Absolutely. It's extremely valuable. Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.